This is Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell, awakening the world to the power of God's Word. And now here is your host, Dr. William Campbell.
We are glad you're with us this morning as we talk about the hard part of the holidays. Now, this is the time of year, having come through Thanksgiving, we're moving into Christmas, and when many people gather as families and many others are lonely. When some people experience great joy and happiness and others sadness. In fact, more than that, as people think of the loss of a loved one, difficulties in their own lives, this can be a time of real grief. And that will be our focus today, the hard part about the holidays. And we have with us Alice Whistler, who has written several novels, but she's also written some nonfiction, including a book that just came out called Getting Out of Bed in the Morning. And Alice's four-year-old son in 1997, her son Daniel died after 8 months of a vigorous battle against cancer. And she has a lot to share with us this morning, all of us, because we all in some areas experience grief. It's part of life. Alice, welcome.
Thank you. It's good to be here. Thanks for having me on your show.
Well, I thank you for being with us, Alice, for this hour. We also have Carolyn Petit with us. Carolyn, welcome.
Hi, it's good to be with you.
Carolyn is with me on staff of the church, and he's been a longtime friend of Alice's, so I thought how appropriate to have them on together. And Carolyn has a lot of insights also about grieving. And so, Alice, what we'd like to do as we start off is just hear a little bit of your story. This will help all of us connect, because we've all got our own stories, yet the connection happens around the hardships of the world, and sometimes it comes to the fore here in the holidays. Tell us how you got into writing this book, Getting Out of Bed in the Morning.
Well, it would have to start with the inspiration of my son. His life and his death inspired me to want to reach out to others through my own struggle, and I think it's been a book that I've been writing in my mind and in various journal pages since his death, as you mentioned, in 1997. Daniel was four. He had cancer. It was neuroblastoma, and the cancer was a mass in the left side of his neck wrapped around his vagus nerve.
Mm-hmm.
He went through chemo, he went through radiation, several surgeries. And actually, they thought he was a poster child for chemo because he was doing well. His hair came out, but he was healthy, running around, had lots of energy. And then because of the nature of the tumor, intense continual chemo started. And every time after that, he was back in the hospital for some unexpected reason. And he died in my arms on February 2nd, 1997, after a staph infection entered his compromised body and took his life. And right then, of course, we'd all been praying for his health. He had even gone down to the chapel at UNC Hospitals in Chapel Hill, North Carolina, to pray and ask God to heal him of his boo-boo. He was three when he was diagnosed and then four when he died. And I just had a hard time believing that God would have allowed for his death. So that began my journey of just agony. I don't ever want to sugarcoat those days. It's been 15 years, but I can still recall the woman then who lost her child. I was 36 years old and pregnant with my fourth child and had a six-year-old who had lost her best friend and also a 17-month-old, and then a husband who was spiraling downward into Great Depression and illness. And I journal a lot. I think I would have to say that was my real blessing there. Didn't realize what a gift it is that God has given us the ability to write and pour out from our heart onto pages. And that's why I'm a big advocate now on teaching the importance of writing through grief and loss.
Mm.
I read a lot of books. C.S. Lewis's book, after the death of his wife, helped. He said that he never knew that grief could feel so much like fear. And I think that's such a good quote, because you do get fearful about your own life, your sanity. Yeah, everything that you once thought was concrete, you begin to question. And that includes your faith. At least for me it did. Everybody responds differently to loss, and even those parents who have had a child die respond differently. But for me it was really stomping out all the thoughts, the concerns, the anger, the frustration, the how come, why, and that really had to be something that I did in order for me to go on and go forward. I don't really like the expression move on. It sounds like, you know, we just kind of bury a person and then we don't continue on with that person ever, and we sort of like, you know, sever the relationship, which is not true, of course, at all. But we carry the loss with us, and it changes us forever. And hopefully, through the process, the loss can help us, drawing closer to God, closer to an understanding of ourselves and what we can do with grief in our society.
Yes, yes. Well, this is, listeners, I just want to open also this program to you. If you wish to call in, you simply call the number 828, and then it's 693-WHKP. You may have had a great loss, or you may have a question for Alice. Yeah, she's out helping others who face their losses. And Alice, you talked about writing, and I understand you've really developed an outreach called Writing the Heartache Workshops. What are those about?
There again, they are workshops that really plug the importance and benefits that come from writing through grief. I started when a friend of mine wasn't able to come to a workshop, and this was at a conference, a national conference called the organization called Compassionate Friends, which has an outreach to bereaved parents and siblings. And so a friend wasn't able to come due to the health issues, and she said, Alice, you write, you can come and fill in for me. So that was my first workshop, and after that I developed the courses online and offer those online. So I speak at conferences and at seminars across the country and hold a lot of all-day workshops locally. And really the beauty of it is people have internally their ability to create. It's me just working as a teacher, as an instructor. People have already, you know, they kind of quit with their grief, their pain, their joys, their sorrows, and just allowing them to have the freedom to write them down on paper is what I do.
And I take it from that you would encourage anyone who's going through grief, if they're into writing, and more of us should be than we realize, to write it out, to journal it, to express your anger at God, your disappointment with life. Put it all down, whatever it is. Just get it out. Don't hold it in. Is that right? Is that what you'd encourage?
Oh, definitely, yes. I think we have a lot of pent-up feelings in our heart, and, you know, our heart can only carry so much. Writing releases the pent-up emotions. And I think it also helps you to see that your problems that maybe seem so large in your mind and heart actually can be contained on a sheet or sheets of paper. And I think that helps kind of getting some of that out of your heart onto the paper, and you realize you don't have to keep carrying this. It's been written, it's recorded, you're not going to forget how you feel. And then I think you can deal with it better when you see it there on black and white.
Alice, I know that you've worked a lot with the Psalms. The Psalms have been a major example for me dealing with my grief, losing my father, of watching David just absolutely pour out every emotion that he has in his heart, just the anger, the fear, the doubt, the confusion, and yet this determined faith in the midst of it all. Have you tell us a little bit about what you've experienced with the Psalms and how that's formed your writing.
Hi, Carolyn. It's so good to hear your voice. We miss you here in Durham, North Carolina. The Psalms, I'm so glad you brought that up. Yes, I had a new love affair with the Psalms when my son died. It was as if the Psalms had been penned just for me. And I was excited to know that, you know, even though maybe my Presbyterian heritage had not allowed for me to be disappointed or angry with God, I could read the Psalms and realize, hey, someone else has already done it. And, you know, he was David was beloved by God and a man after God's heart, and so it's okay to admit what God already knows is going on in my heart anyway. So I enjoyed reading them, enjoyed in the sense of just basking in the sorrow and anguish and lament, and I liked some of the Psalms that didn't necessarily, you know, end in praise the Lord, but kind of got stuck there and were sad from the beginning to end. And then I also like the way that some of them start off in dismay, in despair, but then ends up, you know, praising God at the end. And I teach a Writing the Psalms workshop online. It's a 3-week course to try to get people to see the value of using the Psalms. I think it really helps improve a writer's work as well, as you freely stress your emotions and see what's in there and find new ways to praise God also.
And I'm just looking at the back of your book. It mentions if someone wants to pick up the blog on broken psalms, they would go to Daniel House workshop.blogspot.com. Alice, what do you recommend if people are listening, they want to start, you know, finding you on the internet, maybe go to alicewhistler.com, or what do you recommend?
That's perfect. Okay. Yes, Alice Whistler is a good one to go to, because there are links there for Writing the Heartache workshops, other online workshops. There is the cover of Getting Out of Bed in the Morning, and you can click that, and that will take you to Broken Psalms, which is a new blog I've created for the purpose of this book. And there are also other blogs that I have, Writing the Heartache, .blogspot, and then there's one called just a patchwork quilt, which is alicewhistler.blogspot, and that's kind of a catch-all for book reviews, anything I feel like promoting or getting out there. It's kind of a hodgepodge of things.
Now, your book, Getting Out of Bed in the Morning, was just released, is that right?
It's funny, because at first it was supposed to be released in February.
Mm-hmm.
And then they said, no, we're going to release it in January. So right now I have copies of the book, and people can gladly find out about me and order copies if they want. But actually the official publication date is January 8th, I believe. And that was because Lifeway Bookstores decided they wanted it earlier because they're going to be doing a promotional on it the third week of December. And I think it's ideal to get it out there before Christmas, because I think that many people who have friends that are grieving and having a difficult time, not just with the loss of a child or a loved one, but other losses that we have in our lives, I think it's a book that would be helpful for others, because it is real and it is raw, and it does turn to Scripture a lot for, you know, for help and for healing.
Well, I encourage listeners, having just read the book, Getting Out of Bed in the Morning, to, in 2.5 weeks when it comes out at your local Lifeway bookstore, get yourself a copy. This is, Alice, as we're talking about the use of the Psalms, I feel as though there's a real parallel here. We find you devotionally walking us through not just stages of grief, but the stages of your own healing. And it was a fascinating read, and it is very devotional, much like the Psalms. Do you want to comment on the book? And it was interesting to me how it was that you took up walking. I almost feel as though every chapter I'm encouraged to get out and walk. And
well,
so talk to us about it. Yeah.
That's good. I am not an exercise person at all. I enjoy swimming, tennis, as poor as I am at tennis. But it can't be, you know, exercise. So going to the gym, sweating it out, working on the treadmill, gotta love my friends who really enjoy doing that. But that's not for me.
Mm.
And so as the book talks about, in the beginning, I was taking my son to his job. He was 15 at the time, and I noticed the paths along a certain road in Durham, and I saw other walkers and joggers along them in their Reeboks and, you know, nice-looking exercise outfits that are all color-coordinated, and I thought, ooh, that really looks inviting. Trees are on one side, and for Carolyn, who's from Durham, or was in Durham, it's a picket road.
Okay, right, it's a beautiful area.
Lovely, and then there's a park behind, you know, a certain area, too, that I enjoy walking, and a lot of times people aren't there, so I can actually talk out loud. you know, to God. And maybe that's why people aren't there. They think I'm crazy, so they avoid walking near me. But the idea of walking was slow. I tried before to get some sort of, don't call it exercise, but, you know, heart-healthy program going. Just wasn't working at all. And then I ended up becoming disciplined with walking, which is still a shock and surprise to me. But little did I know that I did have some stress in me because of what was going on in my life. I don't think we ever are fully free of problems when we're on Earth, and so there was other things going on, and the walking just helped to alleviate some of that stress, and I looked forward to my walks every day. So when I had the book Getting Out of Bed in the Morning and the proposal for the publisher said, you know what, you had at the end of every devotion in your book, you have a section called If You Walk. I want to make it more positive, said the publisher at Leafwood Publishers. I would like it to say When You Walk. So there you go. That, you know, if you're feeling like, oh, goodness, I have to walk now, it's the positive side. And, yes, there are little tidbits for meditation and some ideas for those who do walk, because I think walking, praying, meditating on God's Word, as well as your frustration, anger, disappointments, are perfect for showcasing when you walk, talking about them, getting them out there. And I think you can solve a lot of problems, too, while you're walking. Something about the endorphins, I guess.
Yeah, fantastic. Alice, let's... Walking is one part of the answer you bring to us in a book and through your own story. And let's talk to our listeners now about the grief we all face, each in our own way. Yours around the loss of Daniel, and I'm sure other things in your life also can bring that sense of heaviness and sadness, almost an overwhelming sense in your life. What have you learned as tips to help us? We all want to learn from you. How can we survive our grief better than that, grow through it, become better people in the midst of it and because of it? Start us off on that journey.
I think the process of this book, to go back to the book, starts with the deep, agonizing feelings and emotions that you have when someone dear to you is no longer with you on Earth. I really am grateful that I was able to stress that, because, like I said earlier, I don't want to sugarcoat anything. I think sometimes when time has passed, we get to maybe forget some of the rougher edges of grief, but it doesn't take much to remind me of that woman 15 years ago, and I know that now there, people are experiencing their own loss in very real, new ways, and the grief is fresh, and I want to be able to relate to those people, too, and say, yes, it's awful right now. It's horrible. You wonder if you can get out of bed in the morning. But, and I think that right there is maybe a crossroads we come to. Are we going to try to continue to survive, live, possibly thrive in a joyful way with God, or are we going to just act like it's over? Because that's the way we might feel, and not want to do anything about it. And I think that it's important to deal with our own internal struggles. I think it's also important to open our eyes and see we're not alone. There are lots of other people who are going through just as difficult, maybe even more difficult pain and circumstances than we are experiencing. And we can actually help them.
Yeah.
And in turn, you know, as we reach out to them, they help us, and there's that wonderful little way it all seems to work out there. Sometimes it just takes taking that initiative and getting out there and reaching out, and I think then so many wonderful things can happen then. So that would be something that I would say, you know, and get out with other people that are experiencing other losses too.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe people who are further on down their grief journey and see what they've done. Of course, you want to look for the positive ways of healing. There are plenty of people that don't necessarily choose the best ways for healing. But
here, let me prod you. Chapter 4, you talk about anger, and you suggest maybe even getting in a room, setting a timer for 3 minutes and let yourself think about it. Scream, rant, and rave. Talk to us about anger. Where does that lie in the process of grief? How did you deal with it?
Well, I was so angry that my son died. When I was certain, you know, everything was going to be okay, we'd never been told that the cancer was taking over his body and there was no hope. It wasn't until an infection came in, and I thought that was kind of a cheap shot in infection, you know, so that put him in a comatose state for a while. They took him off the machines, the ventilator, and he still lived. So I was thinking, okay, maybe this is God's time. He's going to work this miracle and, you know, raise up my son again, and my son's going to be coherent and going to be able to live. And, of course, that didn't happen. And I cannot really stress how frustrated and disappointed and angry I was. And I think that I was also frustrated and disappointed with a variety of Christians. And that hurt because I felt like people wanted me to shape up, get over this, move on. You know, trust God. God can give you more than you can handle, or all these other kind of cliches and things, and, you know, scripture verses that are taken out of context, and people, you know, telling me all about Job, and I just felt that it would have been so nice, and I was grateful for those people who took the time to just let me cry and let me talk. There's therapy in that. I don't know if I ever set a timer for 3 minutes, but that is an example. I give it the book. I probably was not as disciplined. Probably just went on and on. And then again, the journal writing helped, just to be able to honestly pour things out, maybe things that I wouldn't be able to confess to another person or wasn't ready to for whatever reason. Writing worked well for me so that I could rant and rave and fume on the pages and realize, oh, okay. It's okay. You know, God has not set down hellfire and brimstone. I'm still all right. And I think there was a real distance also in feeling that God was with me, which is so different than how I feel now. But at the time, I felt alienated, abandoned. So that produced a lot of anger within me.
As you mentioned, how people would make comments that were really not that helpful, often Christians, maybe even some of your close friends. You mentioned in the book some of those comments. And I'm going to ask you a question, and then we're going to take a moment of break and have you answer it right after that break. But here are some of the comments you mentioned in your book. Be glad he's in a better place. Or God needed another flower in his garden. Or at least you have other children. And then one we hear so commonly, God doesn't give us more than we can handle. So when we come back in 1 minute, Alice, I want you to tell the listeners why those comments didn't help and how people should have maybe been more helpful. Tips for those of us who have friends who are grieving. What can we say or maybe not say that will be helpful? And so we'll be back in just 1 minute.
Have you ever wanted to read the entire Bible from cover to cover? Most Christians have. And you may even be among those who have attempted it. Yet only 10% of Christians have ever read the entire Bible. B90, or Bible in 90 Days, is a Bible reading program that can help you achieve this important goal for your life and for your spiritual development. By reading only 12 pages a day, you and your friends, your Bible study group, or even your entire church can read the Bible in 90 days. To find out more about B90, visit us on the web at scriptureawakening.com and click on B90, Bible in 90 Days. Read every word that God has spoken and shared with humanity. Check it out. That's B90 at scriptureawakening.com.
This is Bill Campbell. Carolyn Petit's in the studio with us, and we have Alice Whistler on the phone. Alice is an author. She's written several novels. She lost her son Daniel, just 4 years old, back in 97. Since then, she founded Daniel's House Publications. It's a grief organization to help other parents cope with their grief. And we're talking in part about her new book, Getting Out of Bed in the Morning, as we focus on the hard part of the holidays. So, Alice, we just a minute ago left you with a question we'd like you to answer. How should we talk to someone who's grieving? You've shown us how not to do it in your book.
Yes, that's important, isn't it?
Yes.
To know how to help somebody grieve or how to be there alongside them. I actually did write an article a long time ago that was printed in a parent magazine here locally, and it said the title of it was, You Can Help a Grieving Heart, and I think there might be some references to it online, but I gave tips on what people can do, and this is particularly for those who had a child die, for their friends to know how to help them. And I think some of the tips can go across the board. It doesn't necessarily have to be only when a child has died. It could be from losing someone else or other hardships that we have. Mm. Just knowing that somebody is grieving and is going through a difficult time, I think, first of all, you have to acknowledge their pain and really see that it is detrimental to them, that it is something that they are carrying with them, and they're not necessarily thinking that it's easy or that you shouldn't think that, you know, it's easy. I think that we might try to weigh other people's grief and go, oh, well, they've been through that, well, I've been through this, but that's not the point at all. That's why I think we first have to look at what they're going through, whether it be, you know, a layoff and they're wondering about their finances, or illness that's debilitating and going to cause them to change in life, or the loss of a loved one. I think that we have to see that and try to put ourselves somehow in the person's shoes so that we can have empathy. Mm. Often the problem is people just kind of want to whisk it away or act like it's not a big deal. You stop and think, this person doesn't have her mother anymore. Or this person's father is gone, and she will, you know, not be able to celebrate another birthday or a momentous occasion or event with him, and he's gone. And the memories are what are left, and there's no way to make the new memory. And so after having done that, I think that the understanding, praying for the person is great, but I think the humility is important, too. We don't want to act like others are going through situations and, you know, we're so much better off because we've got our lives together. This sort of, you know, haughty feeling, which I'm sure, I hate to think that any Christian does that, but, yeah, we are faulty in many areas. And just a real compassion, I think, is important. Mm. And that if it is someone who has recently lost a loved one at Christmas time or before Christmas, or this is their first series of holidays, Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, definitely realize that they are going to have a difficult time. They might appear okay one day and able to join in an event, and then the next week they just not want to accept the invitation to the Christmas party or to the concert. Mm. And being able to accept that and not judge them for what they can and cannot handle.
Mm. Excellent. So, Carolyn, Carolyn, as a pastor, have you noticed in the holidays that there's more grief that comes to the surface typically in people's lives? Or
absolutely. I've seen a lot of people, they're doing okay, they've got their routine down, and then suddenly the holidays will bring up deep memories or even regrets, or if only I could spend a little bit more time with this person. The holidays are so packed with emotion and experience and memory and tradition that when this person is no longer part of that life, is no longer part of the scene, suddenly that exposes all the wounds that have kind of scabbed over and started to heal, but it just rips them open again. And Alice, I was going to ask you, have you seen that kind of thing, and especially in the workshops you've been with, are the holidays especially unique in that way?
Yes. In fact, I have a perfect example today. A woman who was taking my right, she said she didn't think that she could continue on at this time because this was her first season of holidays without her child. Mm. And so she's like, could I just maybe hold off right now? I've, you know, done the first two lessons, but it's, I think I've bitten off more than I can chew, and it's sort of overwhelming right now, and I would like to just take some time. And so I said, oh, yes, you know, you can join us in the new year if you're up for it. But, of course, my advice also would be that she would take care of herself, and I was glad that she knew enough about her own self to know she couldn't write right now. So there again, it's something that I advocate, saying writing's healing, healthy, but sometimes there are people that will say, no, can't do that right now. Gotta save my energy or time for getting through this. And I think, I know for a fact with the loss of a child, thinking about the holidays and what it's going to be like without them is almost worse than the actual holiday.
Wow.
But I agree with you with the memories and the traditions. You know, we don't have that person around the table anymore to share those with, person to make a new comment or a new memory. And so we've got the old ones. And I think if we can acknowledge that person and not let it be like his death, the elephant in the room, something we don't want to talk about, but instead we can say something. Just, it doesn't have to be, the whole conversation doesn't have to be centered around the person who's died. Just, I think those that are grieving can know that the other family members or guests at the table can acknowledge that there is a missing person. That, I think, really helps the situation. Early on, I think when people would just say to me, you know, I know this is hard for you, or, you know, how old would your son have been now, or just something. That's sometimes all you need. Mm-hmm. Oh, good. They realize it's difficult. They're acknowledging that my son lived. They're not shoving it under the carpet and acting like I should be okay and that his absence is not clearly present.
Excellent. I've Alice, lost a couple brothers over the last few years, one of them just over a year ago, and so I was emailing his wife this morning. She just lost her youngest, most loved brother yesterday. To have that hit her, plus the loss of her precious husband all at once here, as I wrote, I thought, one thing I can do for her is bring up the memory of my brother, her husband, who's with the Lord, and talk about that, and talk about how precious her other brother must have been. I've just learned through the years what you're telling us, and you know so deeply, is when someone's grieving, don't avoid the subject. Go right to it. And if someone's maybe dying of cancer, talk about it with them. Say, what? Tell me about your cancer. What kind? You know, that's what people need, isn't it? Get to the heart of the matter. Yeah.
It is. I think if we just try to sweep things under the carpet or act like the problem or the circumstance or the pain is not there, we're really doing a disservice to everybody. And I guess people will never fully be comfortable with grief. It's sort of, you know, people like to toss it aside or act like it doesn't exist, but it does. And even in all my novels, I make sure that there is somebody in there who's grieving, because I think it's a part of life, like you said earlier. And we have to, I think, own up to that and ask sometimes the hard questions that might make us uncomfortable, but it's really helping the people that are grieving. And they're, most of the time, they are grateful that their child or their husband or brother's name is mentioned. Just saying a name sometimes, because we don't get to say it often when the loved one is gone.
Yes.
Just saying the name is very meaningful.
And talking about how
life-giving.
Just how precious. I'm sure when people, instead of saying, God knew you could handle it, that kind of thing, when they said Daniel, if they knew him, what an incredible young man, how you must miss him. Or if they didn't know him, he must have been quite an incredible young man, just from hearing you talk about him. I mean, that does a lot for you, doesn't it?
It does. And I think as a parent, too, one more thing I've been thinking of, when our child dies, we go into this feeling of it was our fault. Now, you know, medical staff can try to prove to me, which they did, it's not your fault, you know, that he got the cancer or this infection. But of course you're thinking, oh, should have seen this sign, should have known this, you know, because we're supposed to be protectors of our children. So we feel like we are failed, and along with that we feel like we have a lot of regrets. I think being able to own up to those and then forgive yourself for those is important too. And as you're thinking about your child and you know what he meant to you, I think it's also important, like you said, for others to share the memories and say things that are affirmative. One woman said, you know, I know that Daniel had a wonderful mother.
Mm.
And that meant a lot to me because I wasn't feeling too wonderful at the time. My child had died, and you know, I'm blaming myself. Even though part of me knew it wasn't my fault, still it's, you know, that whole weird thing about being a mom that's there. And I think when people who didn't know him just kind of reflected on the rest of our family and the memories I would share about him would say things like, you know, I wish I had known him. And the memories of a four-year-old or the memories that you have and others have of a four-year-old are small. And, you know, so I think, I only got 4 years, but then again, you reach out to other people and you see some people only got a day.
Wow.
Some people only got a week.
Yeah.
And so you are grateful. I think that's key right there for what you had. And instead of focusing just on the death, focus on the life.
Very good. Very well put. Sometimes as you come to people and you're trying to minister to them, they may have questions, as you express in your book, the chapter you have titled God of Mystery. When my son died, I wanted to know why. What should we tell people? And Carolyn, you may wish to weigh in also as a theologian pastor, but what do we tell people when they're saying, why God?
Well, let Carolyn, the theologian pastor, answer that.
I was still waiting for you to come up with a great answer, Alice. Yeah, God's ways are higher than our ways, and it's one of those things where we have to, in my own experience, have just had to yell at God and lay it all out before God and say, I don't understand why, but I'm going to trust you anyway. There's a psalm that says, I will yet praise you, my master and my God. And so, you know, my dad died of an aneurysm in less than 20 minutes. I mean, he was just gone, and I didn't get to say goodbye. And I've the why question has been with me for so long. But I think David and his lament psalms are so amazing. He's able to have the why questions even hanging out there while at the same time he says, I will yet trust you. So sometimes we'll never know the why on this side of heaven, but we also know that Jesus Christ came into this earth. He's incarnate, walked this dirt, knew grief and sorrow himself, and knew pain and betrayal and everything else. And so our God has this understanding of what it's like to live in this flesh that's so much more infinite than we can even grasp. So we can sit with him and give him the why and find comfort in that.
That's great. I think that I was looking at Psalm 13:5, but I trust in your unfailing love. My heart rejoices in your salvation. I think one thing I have found, too, realizing that I'm never going to have the answers to the whys, is just to focus on God's love. I think I kind of missed out a lot on that, too. Or maybe it does take a whole lifetime and then some to really embrace God's love. Maybe we never can fully do it on earth. It is so vast and wonderful. And focusing more, maybe it's in my older age, about God's grace and mercy, too. And getting to know him and letting my desire to know more about his love, grace, mercy, forgiveness, instead of just focusing on the whys and the how comes. Getting to know God better than my problems, I guess. And trusting in him, which is such a cliche sometimes when people just throw around, just trust God. And you're thinking, their life is a piece of cake. What are they talking about? You know, how can they say that to me when my life seems so difficult? But I think that getting to know God helps with the trusting of God, too, as you would get to know a friend. And that has helped me. And I wouldn't necessarily throw that on anybody who has just lost a child to feel like they're supposed to, you know, just be trusting God and everything's all right. Some people can do that. Like I said, everyone grieves differently. But for myself, you know, I was one that did not trust God and thought that God and I would sort of be just on passing standards, you know, hi, hello, and that would be it. And I would not entrust anything to him anymore.
One thing that I also wanted to bring up, Alice, that I've experienced in my own grief and I've seen some other people do, it's maybe different from grieving from an adult versus a child, but being able to face the person's flaws, to be able to say this person wasn't perfect, and that's okay. We can kind of sit with that. One memory that my family always laughs about now, I have 7 nieces and nephews, and my dad could not stand the noise. And when we'd all get together at the holidays, he would often go hide because it would be so crazy and chaotic, and he just couldn't take it. His father had been an alcoholic, and the holidays were an awful time for him, and he hated Christmas. And didn't hate Christmas, but it was not his favorite holiday. So somehow being able to acknowledge that about my dad, and we do laugh about it when it gets really crazy, like, oh, it's a good thing Dad's not here. But I know that he loved these kids so much, and he loved being a granddad. But I think there's an important space of letting that person that we're grieving also be imperfect, that we don't have to sweep over all of their flaws and put them on this pedestal, because they were real, they were human, and that's okay, and that's part of how we love them.
That is so true. And I thought, you know, had my son lived, I thought, I don't want kids to resent him and think he was spoiled, as unfortunately many cancer kids are. And when a nurse pointed out that, you know, I disciplined him and I didn't spoil him, I thought, good, because he's going to live. He's going to live, and he's got 3 other siblings, 1 on the way and 2 other ones that are alive right now. And I don't want them to think that he's this bratty kid. I don't want his friends, his other little 3- and 4-year-old friends, to grow up thinking that he got his way because he had cancer and he was, you know, this difficult child. I wanted it to be pleasant and disciplined and on and on and on. And, of course, those dreams all died because he died. But I think that the memories I have of him and share with my family are memories that are much more realistic, like you said. And not everybody is there. Some people feel like they can't share the real memories. They have to just sugarcoat it, make it sound like their loved one who died was perfect. But there's freedom in being able to say, you know what? He was a difficult baby. He whined a lot. or, you know, he was this way. Or like you said about your dad, you know, he wasn't fond of all the noise.
And that's why part of being human, isn't it? We love people around us. Sometimes with all their quirkiness, they're even more lovable, even as we feel the rough edge at times. So this is really good conversation. Now, as we go forward, Alice, in your book, you have this flow from the depths of grief. As you have 5 sections in the book. Again, I'm referring to Getting Out of Bed in the Morning, a book, listeners, that will come out in about 2.5 weeks on the internet at your local Lifeway bookstores. We've got the start with the weeping and moving toward nurturing, but finally it moves to a sense of thriving and hoping. With 40 entries, it would be unrealistic, obviously, for someone who has just lost a loved one or has gone through a really hard hit in life to think that in 40 days it would all be over. And yet, obviously, a book like this can give you hope. So speak some words of hope to us about, maybe it takes 2 years to start feeling some normalcy, but give us a sense of a pattern that would give a little hope and confidence to the listener who's grieving right now.
I think it lasts longer than we expect it to. I think that we sometimes get frustrated with ourselves. I've heard people say that, tired of it hurting so much. But it does. And we can't speed up the process. So there are people who will try to avoid grief, and they will just keep themselves busy. They're fearful of many things. Of course, there's been a lot of talk about grief versus depression, and people wonder, am I depressed? And, you know, a whole slew of people will say one way yes and someone else no, and oh, it's normal. And so you really have to gauge even yourself too, and sometimes you can think, oh no, I'm going crazy. All this noise going on in my head, I can't turn it off, and all the memories depending on, you know, who died or what you were grieving over. And I think that, yes, it's unrealistic, and I don't think that's at all what I'm trying to do by saying, you know, within 40 days you can get over this, or you can be even changed. I think it's just a start to just kind of dive in, and I'll tell people you can read any chapter, anytime, you know, or the same chapter over and over again, or skip chapters. You can kind of move around in this book depending on what you think might be meaningful to you at the time. So I would really like to see this book more as like a handbook, a tool that would stay on the shelves. Maybe that's really lofty thinking there, but then that people would be able to go back to it and you know, pick out things that might mean something to them in the course of their rocky journey. And one woman recently asked if it would be a good book that she could send to a family member who is grieving the loss of a child. And, you know, I don't know the situation, so I just had to send it to the mother-in-law, and she could take a look at it and see if it was appropriate for her daughter-in-law. So I'm not at all, you know, saying by any means that this book is going to be something that all grieving people will embrace. It could be some of it that, you know, people are not ready for, but I do think that day by day, realizing that you're on this journey and there's really no way to get out of it, the circumstance which has brought you onto this rocky path is going to keep you on there, but there are ways to survive. And sometimes that's all you can do. Get out of bed in the morning and make a cup of tea. Try to do a couple little things to help you. I think people will say, you know, I took a shower today, or I did this, or I went back to work. And all those little milestones help. But you really need, I think, somebody to be able to talk to about it. And even if it's just one person, someone to help you along. And I know some people feel like having a therapist or counselor is important. Some people go to support groups. And I also mentioned that in the book. That's helpful. Some people have a helpful spouse, and some people feel like their spouse grieves differently than they do, so that they're not comfortable kind of sharing. There's journaling. There's reaching out to others. There's also doing things, I think, in memory of your loved one, which is helpful. Something life-affirming that you can do, giving to a charity or starting an organization, or even just writing something for your church newsletter.
Excellent. Excellent. We have got just about 3 minutes left, and I wonder if either you or Carolyn would want to give some final comments to our listeners. Again, I have a firm belief as a pastor that everybody experiences grief, even now at some stage, because this world is broken, and God is our healer, but life is just not easy. What final comments would, maybe start with Carolyn Denellis, a final word to our listeners?
One thing I was thinking about was that during the holidays, it's important for us to acknowledge the different kinds of grief we might have. Different ones of us are experiencing broken relationships or estranged relationships. I've talked to several people recently who have non-Christian children, and they're just weeping over that. You know, it may be the loss of a loved one, but there are just an infinite number of other types of grief, lost expectations, and your life not turning out the way you thought it would. And I think as we go through the holidays, it's important for us to think about that and to lay all of that down before the Lord, because He can help us in the midst of whatever grief we're facing.
Alice.
Yeah, that is so true. That is true. And there's so much brokenness that does come out, especially in the holidays, and I think it's because people have a myth that they're living, thinking that it is such a happy, glorious time. I mean, can we really live up to the Norman Rockwell paintings? Is a family really that functional, you know? And the dysfunction that can come out, and all the ways that we can feel like we are not measuring up or living up to the commercials that we see or what the media is stressing about the holidays. I think sometimes it's important to realize that Jesus came to this broken world, and life is not all about, you know, happiness, just excitement, you know, the new car or the gift or the diamond or whatever the TV show is showing you that you need this Christmas. The simplicity, I think, and the profundity of the gospel is really something that we can focus on. And I had a manger scene. I bought a little ornament that was broken when I got it off the clearance rack at a bookstore years ago after Daniel died, as I was wondering how he was going to celebrate Christmas. And I think that broken ornament that's been glued together just shows me as it's a picture of the manger scene, and I think of how Jesus came into this broken world. It's okay to have to deal with the suffering that comes with this world. Jesus suffered, we suffer, and yet, like Carolyn said, in the midst of that, knowing that Jesus is there, he's real, he wants to partake in the journey with you.
Alice, thank you for being with us. Listeners, thank you for joining us. This has been Alice Whistler. You can go to alicewhistler.com. Her last name is spelled W-I-S-L-E-R. And be sure to join us next Monday as we talk about the need to be daring enough to discern in an age of confusion. Thank you again, Alice.
Thank you so much.
God bless you.
This has been Beyond Words with Dr. William Campbell. Beyond Words is a ministry of Scripture Awakening. And if you'd like to help support this ministry, or if you would like to know more about Beyond Words, visit us on our website at scriptureawakening.com.